The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. Get the power to do more with Sky's best ever Wi-Fi.
Matt Haig has become very well known over the last 6 of 7 years. His book Reasons to Stay Alive really resonated with readers. That was his difficult but life-affirming memoir of his mental health struggles. But his latest novel, The Midnight Library, a huge hit among the Tuberty team, is no different. It's already a massive bestseller. It might just have some lessons on how to cope with adversity and how to stop wishing for a better, different life. Matt, good morning to you. I suppose, can I ask you, how much of the premise do you want to give away, or how far up to it do you want to give away?
The Midnight Library of the title is this infinite library between life and death, which the main character, Nora, finds herself in after, she's taken an attempt on her own life. Her life was at sort of rock bottom, and then she finds herself in this infinite library where every single book on the shelf is a different version of her own life if she had lived it a different way. And to access those lives, she has to take a book off the shelf, open it up. But the thing is, she has to really find a life that's for her, a life that's worth living, because the library will sort of crumble to dust and her with it if she doesn't find that life. That's basically it.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible because it starts out very grim. I mean, you're in the life of Nora Seed and you can see there's no hope. And then suddenly it just opens up all these endless possibilities in life. And that's why people, I think, are really into it. Did you want Nora to have very different lives? How did you choose where she was going to go from the Midnight Library?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wanted it to be a mix of lives which were relatively close to her own, relatively sort of realistic ones, and then throw in a few wilder ones, because the whole sort of point of the idea of a multiverse is that, you know, almost any version of our life could be lived somewhere. So there is the life where she's like an Olympic medalist, you know, a champion swimmer. There's a life where she's a super clever scientist, a glaciologist in the Arctic Circle. There's a life where she's a rock star. But there's also the lives which are a bit more closer to home, the life where she sort of stayed with the guy who she broke up with, the life where she's a sort of wife and mother, the life where she's an academic, all different paths that she could have taken.
It's great fun. It must have been great crack coming up with it.
It was great fun. It was a bit of a nightmare as well, because obviously when you're writing about different lives with the same people, you're kind of writing 12 mini novels in one. So even if the chapters are super short, and I'm a big fan of short chapters, you're still having to do a lot of research. Certainly, like if you're setting a scene in the Arctic Circle, you have to know more than you're actually putting on the page to look like you know what you're talking about. But yeah, it was great fun.
I mean, it's the best kind of, I suppose, quasi-fantasy, because it's so rooted in reality. But there is a fair bit of science to it as well, isn't there?
I didn't want to get too bogged down with the science, because, you know, no one wants to read a sort of science textbook. But I also wanted people to actually believe in the Midnight Library. So halfway through, there's this character called Hugo. I won't explain the full purposes, therefore, but he explains the science behind it. And I don't consider myself a science person. Science was always my worst subject at school. But as an adult, I get so much inspiration and fascination from science. And I feel like, you know, the latest scientific theories, a lot of quantum physics and stuff, does suggest the idea of parallel universes and uncertainty. And I love that. I love that concept. And I love the concept that we can enter a different universe simply by making a different decision in our life. So a lot of that stuff's in there.
Particularly because in Nora's universe, of course, it's dramatically, her life is dramatically different, but there are shades of familiarity to the kind of root life that she's kind of left behind momentarily.
Yeah, that's it, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, so it's not really a sort of collection of little episodes. She's learning as she goes, and she's seeing the same characters as she goes, because obviously she's got the same brother in every life, she has the same parents in every life, she has, you know, the same best friend in a lot of her lives as well. And so her relationship with those people subtly changes through the book.
The Midnight Library, it's just one of those books that people reading it, they've had lots of eureka moments about themselves, haven't they? And they're sharing them with you as they go along.
Yeah, that's the nice thing, and that was quite unexpected, really. I mean, you never know when you're writing a book how it will resonate with other people. All you can do, if you want to write truthfully, you have to sort of know your own taste and know what you would want to read, and that's the only reader you'll ever truly know is yourself. So you're kind of self-indulgently writing a book for yourself and then hoping other people will get something out of it. With The Midnight Library, it was almost like self-therapy for me. It was a way of coming to terms with my own life and possible regrets, and, you know, I've always struggled with self-acceptance, and it was basically me trying to sort my own mind out in this book, and it's lovely to see that it's doing that to other people as well.
It's incredible that you kind of even share that idea. I mean, you've sold millions of books, you've had in many ways kind of parallel universe careers even as a writer, haven't you?
Well, yeah, but I did my time as, you know, your archetypal struggling writer. I was like, I think, it makes me sound super old. I'm only 45, which isn't ridiculous, but I think this is book number 20, if you put them all together. A lot of people think the first book I wrote was a book about my mental health called Reasons to Stay Alive, but that was actually my 10th book. I wrote a lot of books that no one read. For a long time, I was, you know, very much under the radar. So I've seen it from both sides. But yeah, The Midnight Library has definitely, you know, placed me up a notch. But it's just lovely as a writer because writing itself, you're always alone. Whatever stage you're at in your career, when you're writing a book, it's just you, your laptop, your Word document. And that is actually the best bit of writing, because that's when it's all possibility, and that never changes. That's the bit that's consistent, whether you're an unpublished writer starting out, or, you know, you're Stephen King, whatever, that's the bit that's sort of pure, and that's the bit you have to stay loving if you want to stay doing stuff people want to read, I think.
So it was 10 years writing books before you got the big hit, and it was really because it was true to yourself.
It took me, I mean, when I cringe a little bit when I'm looking back at some of those early books, because it took me a while to find my voice. So I wouldn't exactly say if you like The Midnight Library, you should definitely read everything I've ever written, because some of those early books, well, they were sort of very dark, and a lot of them were written while I was still in recovery and or depressed and stuff. So I was a very different writer back then. It's almost like when you look at old photos of yourself and your hair was some terrible fashion from 1997 or something, and you cringe at the memory. And it's kind of like that. I sort of got, you know, I'm fond of them because they're, you know, things that came from my mind at a certain point in time. But yeah, there's a little bit of cringe there too.
But the cringe is part of you, and you now accept
Exactly. I accept it all.
I mean, talk about people who take bits of the book out and they're sharing it around. I mean, I'm one of those people. I actually photographed bits of the book as I went along. I love this quote. And I'm always looking for kind of, insights into the author's mind. And maybe you tell me I'm completely wrong. But it's one that's actually I've noticed other people were lifting. And it says, maybe that's what all lives were. Maybe even the most seemingly perfectly intense or worthwhile lives ultimately felt the same. Acres of disappointment and monotony and hurts and rivalries, but with flashes of wonder and beauty. So,
Yeah, we kind of need the darkness, I think, sometimes to see the light, isn't it? That's how we see the stars in the sky. Yeah. And I get very sentimental about this because obviously I went through, like a lot of people, I went through experiences of depression. I was suicidal for a good deal of time. And I would never in a million years want to relive those sort of darkest days. But I also think, by the same token, that without that experience, I would not have known so much happiness and gratitude in the present. So I feel like we kind of need it together. You know, we know what happiness is and contentment is and calmness is because we also know what the opposite is. And that is part of life. And we can't sometimes separate the one from the other. And that's actually quite healing to come to terms with that, I think.
Yeah, to even just slow down and consider that as something. But it's full of those little nuggets. And also you do some great quotes as well. The life of a human, according to the Scottish philosopher David Hume, was of no greater importance to the universe than that of an oyster.
Yeah, he was apparently really fun at dinner parties as well, thank you. There you go.
Just in the middle of the main course after someone's told a joke, just land that little nugget. We're just as important as an oyster, really. And By the way, because Nora gets to visit different parts of her life, are there things when you were writing it that you're thinking, yeah, I might like to go back to that place and maybe change that little thing that I did, but in a good way?
Always, always. Yeah. It's funny, the very last bit I wrote in the Midnight Library, it wasn't the last page in the book as the reader reads it. The last thing I wrote, it comes about halfway through, which is a piece about embracing your imperfections and stuff. And that was me basically saying, okay, enough, just leave the novel there. And yeah, the moment you send it off, there's always things you wish you'd done. More so with non-fiction. I think non-fiction, it's easier to sort of do something that you can imagine is perfect. Obviously, it's not perfect, but you imagine it's perfect when you fix it. With a novel, there are always these sort of imperfect, baggy things that you could change in any which way. But you have to get a point where you just say, okay, if I keep changing any more, it's actually going to get worse because I'm going to over-fiddle with it, overthink it. And there's a sort of sweet spot between, you know, not doing any editing at all, which would be terrible, and then doing too much and tinkering around too much. And you've just got to sort of know when you're at that point where you're getting too worried about it. And then before you get there, you just send it off. So, yeah, it's a totally imperfect book, but it's a totally human book, and I, you know, put my heart into it.
That's kind of the life, isn't it? You can't go back and change a little bit
exactly.
if you want as well. Do you make any changes to your own life?
Yeah, I mean, well, this book was actually just quite a healing process for me.
All right.
But it's almost about not worrying too much about what I couldn't change. It was, you know, not worrying too much about what I have regretted in the past. I don't really have regrets anymore. I mean, the only regret I really have, you know, like I used to be quite good at the piano, and then I stopped playing the piano at 14 because I was like self-conscious teenage boy. You know, all the lads were playing football. I just felt, you know, not right going to Mrs. Peters on a Friday evening playing the piano. So stupidly, I stopped playing the piano. And I tried to pick it up at the age of 45, and I'm doing it with my 12-year-old son, who is amazing because he's 12, so he just learns things so fast. And there's nothing more humiliating being 45 years old trying to learn the same skill with a 12-year-old who just is like a sponge, and you're there stuck at the same level. But no, I don't really do regrets. And this book was very much me trying to just accept where I am and be happy with where I am and be happy for all the mistakes and all the journey and the struggles and all the rest of it and all the things I've done.
All those little wounds along the way, and big wounds are all part of the whole experience. I want to ask kind of, because you're very big on social media, on Twitter. You've, you know, roughly 500,000 followers on Twitter alone, and you really get stuck in, don't you? You get involved. You're not afraid.
Well, yeah, I've probably got too stuck in the past. I'm actually trying to be a bit more afraid going forward because I feel like, I feel like social media is a double-edged sword. It's great as a writer because you can connect to people. You know, it levels that playing field between writer and reader. You can talk to people. You can get engaged in politics.
Yes.
I'm finding actually Instagram is my place. I know people are very cynical about Instagram and they think it's all just sunsets and unicorns, but I actually need a bit of that. I need a bit of people being friendly because I feel like Twitter, sometimes people just go for the argument, and that's fine. Sometimes when you're feeling heated about something political, that's okay. But, you know, as a day-to-day thing in life, I'm trying to get a little bit calmer. So I'm heading over to the sunsets and...
Very nice. I mean, Twitter is life in block capitals, isn't it? Whereas Instagram is italics, maybe.
Yes.
Maybe that's one of it, but you're very shy. Do you think, by the way, has all that cruelty always just been there in the world? All the snarks and the meanness and the flashes of kindness, sometimes peppered with division and alongside nice photos of baby pandas or something?
Yeah,
has it always been there?
Human nature hasn't fundamentally changed, but I think what has changed is we're a bit overloaded by it now. We didn't always have rolling news. We didn't have, you know, every day seeing something that we had to be offended about that every hour of every day. I think that's changed. And I think, like, certain social media sites like Twitter, their sort of business model runs on that.
Yes.
Sort of, so it's not like human nature's changed, but it's being exploited in slightly newer ways. Which
it's literally designed, isn't it? To keep us on it and divide it, and that generates more and more eyeballs and so on.
Yeah.
The Midnight Library is out on paperback, which is why we're chatting to you today. So, but you have another book out in the summer, don't you? Which
I do. Yeah, as I was sort of as I finished Midnight Library, and I felt a bit at a loss, also because, you know, it was 2020, March last year.
Yes, that's what I was going to ask. You wrote a book, another one in lockdown.
Yeah, I wrote, so to keep my mind sane and not, you know, spend all my time on Twitter or looking at, you know, horrible statistics, about COVID, I wrote a book called The Comfort Book, which was just me writing anything I could think of that comforts me, you know, and using other people's quotes, reading recipes in there. There's everything, you know, my favourite movies, different things. So it's a sort of book that you can pick up, not, you know, read from start to finish, but to sort of like page 105 or whatever and just hopefully find something.
That sounds like something else we need as well. What was that experience like? Because I presume you had homeschooling and all of that to do.
Yes, indeed. We're one of those weird people who even homeschool anyway. We've homeschooled our kids for a few years now for all kinds of reasons. But so we didn't have the same level of transition a lot of people had, you know, because obviously I'm a writer, I work from home. We homeschool our kids anyway. I mean, it was a bit different because the town we're in England, in Brighton, it's quite homeschooly. There are a lot of homeschool kids even in normal times. So. They're normally out of groups, so we had them in the house. So, yeah, that was a bit different. But this was the easiest book I've ever written in some ways, The Comfort Book, because it didn't have to be written in order. It didn't have a story. I could sort of dip into it and out of it whenever I wanted. It was just little flashes of anything that would comfort me, you know, looking up quotes on the internet. So it was very much a thing I could do around the homeschooling, around the real life stuff. I could even just do it for half an hour on an evening or whatever, and I could just get into it. So it was quite an easy write, so hopefully it'll be an easy.
It was a good idea, and you were probably writing it halfway through thinking, actually, they won't need this in 2021. It'll be over, but unfortunately
we
do.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. But I deliberately didn't mention the words COVID or pandemic or coronavirus. They're not there. I don't think we need to see those words over and over again, more than we have to in the news anyway. So, yeah, hopefully it's beyond 2020.
That's coming soon, but The Midnight Library, as we say, is out 15 weeks in the New York Times bestseller charts. I saw you tweeting that. That's not shabby at all, is it?
Yeah, it's me showing off on social media again. I think it's just because I get surprised myself, because I have been that struggling writer. This isn't my first book, so I'm kind of grateful for it all, basically.
Well, it's good that you're still getting the thrill out of it, you know, because some people could get blasé about that. It was a very enjoyable book, as well as just having, you know, kind of the timeless message that finding meaning in the suffering, and when you can change your circumstances, maybe you can change your attitude towards them.
Yeah, no, totally. And, you know, last year I got into a lot of the old Stoic philosophy, like the ancient Greeks, and there was this guy called Epictetus, I think that's how you pronounce it. Anyway, he was a slave and eventually a freed slave, and he came up with basically the ancient version of, like, cognitive behavioral therapy. He was like, you cannot change the external things. All we can change is our responses to them. And it's a hard place to get to that place, but once you do, I think that's where freedom is.
Well, let's hope people find the little nuggets for the overall recipe along the way in The Midnight Library.
Indeed.
Matt Haig, thanks a million. Good morning.
Thanks so much. Cheers.
Take care. Bye-bye.